ESPN's Emmy Award-winning 30 for 30 documentary film series presents The Greatest Mixtape Ever, the story of how a series of streetball videos set to music in the 90s transformed basketball's place in the culture, defined the lives of the players who starred in those videos, and changed the game itself forever. Stream now on ESPN Plus and listen to the companion 30 for 30 podcast, A Streetball Mixtape, exploring the essence of streetball through a collection of legendary stories. Listen now on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast on a Friday morning. The NBA Finals are underway, and I am still recovering, shell-shocked, dazed from the Boston Celtics delivering an absolutely hellacious fourth quarter, 40-16, running the Warriors out of their own building, which I still refer to as Oracle, even though it's not Oracle. It's not even the same city as Oracle. An absolute just punch right to the face. The Celtics take home court advantage. They take a 1-0 lead. And if I'm a Warriors fan, you can look at this one of two ways. You can say, well, they hit 21 threes. Al Horford, career high 6 threes. Marcus Smart, 4 of 7. Derek White, 5 of 8. The three of them combined, 15 of 23. They'll never do that again. That's a fluke. That's a just lucky shooting game. And yeah, Tatum was 3 of 17, but he compensated with 13 beautiful assists. He didn't play that badly. We got this. And if I'm a Celtics fan, I'm saying, well, hold on. 3 of 17 is a bad game. You guys shot 19 of 45 from 3. It's not like you guys were some slouches from 3. We just beat your ass. We wore you down with our size, our defense. Once we got through the inevitable first 10 minutes of like, what the hell do we do against this offense? Where's Steph? Oh, we lost him again. Oh, Marcus Smart is yelling at everybody. Oh, my God. Once we got through that, you couldn't figure us out, and you're not going to be able to figure us out going forward. To help us understand which of those reactions is correct, we have, and oh, my God, are we lucky, the one and only, the Hall of Famer, calling this series on ESPN Radio with Mark Kestisher and PJ Carlissimo, Doris Burke. What's up, DB?
Oh, my goodness, Zach. I am so excited to be with you. And I have to tell you, I feel so incredibly lucky to be calling this series. I think you felt it. I think everybody at ESPN who works on this, you know, Bontemps, go down the line of our incredible group of people. I think we expected this series had the potential to be special. And I'm just going to talk about that Warriors crowd for 1 second, because it felt to me, and let's remember that this is a knowledgeable basketball crowd, right? Through all those lean years in Oakland, when those fans showed up and were passionate, to me, when the Boston Celtics absorbed that barrage of threes from Stephen Curry in the first quarter, and the game was still tight, and you knew that the Boston Celtics would find their footing because they found their footing through everything all year, I almost felt like there was this dawning realization in the Chase Center, like, holy, we've got an opponent who is tough, who is well coached, who is up for the challenge. And, you know, certainly the third quarter performance, which has, you know, been the Golden State Warriors, probably, you know, enhance their confidence. I don't know where to begin with what has impressed me the most about the Boston Celtics, Zach. I'll let you start with what impressed you the most, and then I'll react to you. But that fourth quarter, Jaylen Brown sort of triggering that fourth quarter, it took the complete air out of the building. A loud, excited, confident crowd. Just like the Golden State Warriors, I'm going to say two things. Jaylen Brown triggered it. And the most shocking thing to me, and I think I used on the radio cast, the Golden State Warriors looked shaken for a few minutes stretch of action. For the team that had the finals experience, game experience, by a wide margin, it was the Boston Celtics who responded in the fourth.
Well, let's start with that then. Because as many of us predicted, what I call the Golden State knuckleball effect took effect in the first quarter, where the Celtics, after dealing with three pretty basic Eastern Conference offenses, were suddenly presented with this whirring machine of cuts and movement, and they lost Steph like literally five times in transition, in the half court, blowing switches, wide open threes that you know you can't give him. And that was very predictable. That happens to every team in game one against the Warriors. The difference is that the Warriors rarely lose those game ones. They usually run away. And to me, if you want to start with, I agree. You said the name that I wanted to start with. Thank you, DB. All the attention on the role players, not role players. Al Horford's more than a role player at this point. Smart's obviously more than a role player. All the attention on their shooting. Jaylen Brown only shot 10 of 23. Maybe it was the timing of those shots. Maybe it was how emphatic and confident he looked making both jumpers and drives late in the game. The drives specifically late in the game, one of which I want to talk about later. I just thought he was huge in stabilizing them. And if you want to ask me where to start, the survival, the staying in touch, 47-37 second quarter, they're down 10. They're all confused with Curry. They go on a 10-0 run to tie the game. Now, obviously, they fall back behind in the third quarter, but that felt like an important moment to me. And Jaylen Brown had a pull-up, I think, in Wiggins' face, a pull-up in Klay's face, and then Smart hit a one-pass-away three when Tatum posted up Curry on a switch. And the Warriors clearly came into this series saying, when Tatum has a Curry or a Poole, maybe even Klay matchup, we're going to help liberally, at the nail, in your face, digging down off Smart, White, and Horford. And it's not just if they make enough shots, we tip our cap. We're not even letting them have those shots. The three that Smart hit in this situation was kick out, one pass away. Wiggins is right there. Smart has to pump fake, sidestep, and make a three with a rear view contest. Like, that's not an easy shot. That's not a wide open we gave it to you shot. That's the Warriors saying, we're not giving you shots. We're betting on our help and recover defense. That 10-0 run to me felt really big in the moment. And then they made another, it wasn't quite a run, but they made a few threes late in the third quarter. White hit one. Horford hit one in transition in the left corner, which I think was your side of the floor broadcasting it, where yeah. I couldn't tell if they lost him or they were confused about whether they were in zone or man, but there was just nobody was on Al Horford, which was not the only time that happened where they were like, is anyone going to guard this guy? He's shooting 43% on threes in the playoffs. Those little moments to set up the fourth quarter felt big to me, and Jaylen Brown was a part of them.
The other thing, and we touched on this, PJ and I were talking about, it's like Derek White hit some free throws down the stretch of that third quarter. They were massive. Those free throws, you bang in free throws that just, you know, take it from, you know, 14 to 12. It feels different. So you're right. And Jaylen Brown triggers the first 14 points. He rises up on a contested three, gets downhill. He sets his guys up. When you have your stars, I know Jason Tatum is the focal point, but Jaylen Brown's a star. I've always felt like when your stars steady you for that stretch of time, 3 to 4 minutes, not that the Celtics are built with character people. Just both of these teams have high character guys that don't seem to wilt to the moment. It does settle you down. And one thing I was really struck by, and it's really fascinating to me to watch a 24-year-old go through this. How many times in Jason Tatum's career have we seen him, knowing he's supposed to be the guy and being youthful and associating success with scoring, maybe try to force a play? I've watched it through the early part of these playoffs, try to force a play because he thinks he needs a bucket. Now, all of a sudden, he's going, well, I'm 3 for 17. Excuse me. I keep cursing.
I don't care. I love it, DB. Be yourself. Be the Jersey Shore, deep summer Jersey Shore in the 80s, DB. Let's bring it.
He's 3 for 17. He goes for 13 assists, which I think I read this in the Athletic this morning, actually bests John Stockton, Michael Jordan, and Isaiah Thomas for assists in a finals debut. 13 assists from Jason Tatum. And the thing that he's doing now to me is he's moving it quicker. He's absorbing the double, and he's not holding it that extra half second. The smart Tatum pick and rolls that seem to be allowing Marcus to get into a space where he's making all the right plays. I mean, there's just so many things that went right for the Boston Celtics. But to your point about White, Horford, and Smart, It feels to me that that's when my eyes look at the Boston Celtics, and I know the series is a long way from over, and I expect a champion's response from the Golden State Warriors. But just as a viewer, as a fan, when the others are making shots, I'm like, holy shit, this Boston team feels pretty unbeatable when those guys have it going. And listen, can they sustain the three-point shooting? If you listen to the Golden State Warriors postgame, in particular Draymond Green, I'm not sure they believe it's sustainable.
Well, I mean, look, 21 of 41 is obviously not sustainable. They're not going to shoot 50% on threes. Those guys are not going to shoot 15 of 23 on threes. And a lot of Jason Tatum's assists, I watched all 13 again this morning, were simple kick-out passes. You're going to help on me at the nail off Derek White, off Marcus Smart. I'll just give them the ball and trust that they're either going to make a shot or make a play. And they made a lot of shots. I want to highlight a Jaylen Brown play because you mentioned his fourth quarter. 10 points in the fourth quarter. And just sort of like, he looked like he grew in stature. Like when he makes those pull-up jumpers in your face, it's like, oh yeah, I'm 6'8". I'm bigger than you. I'm just going to shoot in your face. And Clay was on him for almost a lot of the game, but in this particular fourth quarter stretch, I thought Clay did all right on Jaylen Brown. But they started hunting Otto Porter. And I don't remember who Otto Porter was guarding at that point, but they started having that guy screen for Jaylen Brown. And he really hurt Otto Porter. He had one open catch and shoot three when Otto Porter kind of fell asleep ball watching on Derek White's drive, I think. And then on another play, and this is the play that I sort of jolted back out of my seat. It was a Jaylen whoever pick and roll to try to get Otto. And he rejected the pick, so Clay was still on him. But Clay fell a little bit behind. He got faked out. It was like 7.5 minutes left in the game. And he drove middle. And so here's Jaylen Brown with a runway in the middle of the floor. Who's the last line of defense? Draymond Green.
Yeah.
And three or four times already in the game, Draymond, who is the best one-on-two defender maybe ever.
And had made several plays last night in that exact situation where he's got great feet, his arms are spread wide, and he's dancing and he's making you think. And he's trying to make you unsure. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
And he got a steal out of that. Maybe even in the fourth quarter, it might have been late third, Jaylen Brown came down in this exact situation and tried to throw an alley-oop to Robert Williams. But either Rob wasn't expecting or it was inaccurate. And that's what happens when Draymond gets in your head. You get confused. He's the best I've ever seen at stunting towards you.
Yes.
Getting back for the pass. Like, he's in your mind. And Jaylen Brown on this drive said, all that, I'm going right at you. I don't care who you are, where you are. And he laid it up. He did a scoop left-handed shot. And I'm like, here come the Celtics. They're learning. They're adapting. They've felt out the game a little bit. And they're growing in confidence. And that layup was like, wow. And the free throws by White at the end of the third quarter, I'm glad you brought that up because that transitions into something. Those happened because Jordan Poole bit on a Derek White pump fake, which you cannot do, and let him drive and score. And Jordan Poole in this game was
a team worst minus 19
on 2 of 7 shooting with 4 turnovers in 25 minutes. Steph and Poole together were minus 13 in 16 minutes. And that brings me to the larger point of this game is you and I talked about this off air before the series. I wrote about it in my column. I was very interested to see how aggressively and how early Boston would go small. They've always preferred to play big with two of Grant and Robert Williams and Horford on the floor. But I thought in that Miami series, the offense just looked easier for Tatum and Brown. The reads were easier when the floor was open. And down the stretch, the entire fourth quarter, I think, they stuck with small ball. They stuck with White and Pritchard a lot in that quarter. Pritchard was big in 15 minutes. I think he stayed on the floor. He made shots. He was actually kind of active on the glass, as was White. Here's the stat of the game, DB, and it's so crazy that I checked it like 4 times on 2 different computers. In 16 minutes with one big man on the floor, some of that was Horford, a little bit of it was Rob Williams. 16 minutes with one big man on the floor.
That's it.
Celtics were plus 31
wow.
in 16 minutes, plus wow. 23 in 9.5 minutes with Horford as the solo big man on the floor. And plus 8, I think, in 6 with Rob Williams as the only big man on the floor. That's the game. Those lineups worked. And I came out of this thinking the greatest small ball team in NBA history doesn't know what its small ball lineup should be because they're afraid to play Poole and Curry together against this massive team. Not afraid. I mean, they played them 16 minutes and it was a disaster. But if Poole can't impact the series on offense and they're going to destroy him on defense and he was terrible defensively, they now face the question, who's the answer to the fifth guy with Steph, Clay, Wiggins, and Draymond? And you and I can go through the answers. But to me, if Boston is the better small ball team, the edge goes to them. I thought the Warriors would have some counters in terms of their small ball lineups and how they might match up against Boston. But look, it's easy to say, well, of course they can't play Poole and Curry together in this series. Boston's too big. Well, sure. But going back to when the Warriors finished 15-5 last year and sort of reestablished themselves as the Warriors, Poole plus Curry plus Green was a huge part of their identity.
They were unbelievable in those settings. And Jordan Poole, to me, like the fearlessness with which he's played, like he earned the trust of Steph and Draymond. This is why there are no meaningless minutes and opportunities in the NBA. That 15-5 run, the play-in game where Jordan Poole did not bow to the moment. He was fearless. I thought he looked young last night. He looked and felt young for the entire 25 minutes he was on the floor, 4 turnovers. And just, I want to go back to your point about Pritchard, because this is where, you know, the NBA is so unique in those little, you know, pockets of play that guys get. When and I love Peyton Pritchard. I love his fearlessness, his shot making, his willingness to compete defensively, even though they're going to hunt him every time. He checked into game 7, and I looked at Mark Jones, who was then calling the radio with me, and I thought, I'm not sure he can play right here and right now. And sure enough, they lifted him after 2 minutes. And Zach, to be a young person and finding your way and your footing, to get lifted after 2 minutes and not come back in a game 7 and go ahead and play in game 1 and do what Peyton Pritchard did, which is go, what did he go, 4-for-5 or 3-for-4? He went 3-for-4. He was on the freaking glass, I think. And he provides a lift and he grinded and I love the mental fortitude that shows. And anyway, I was so impressed. And I'm going to tell you the one most shocking moment to me was a stretch of play. Now, here comes Boston. Jalen gets him out, you know, does the impacts the first 14. The tide swings. The momentum's with Boston. And you found it for me. And you said it was about 2:50 left in the game. 4 different guys had a look for 3. Starting with Steph. And the ball just kept moving. Nobody wanted to take that shot. And I was absolutely shocked. I looked at PJ Carlos and was say, holy smokes, every single guy just passed that ball. And it was a telling moment. Listen, they're champions. You have guys that are 3-time champions. I expect a big time response, but just couldn't be more impressed by Boston. And who do you think they go to? I thought it was interesting that Andre Iguodala gets 12 minutes, makes 3 or 4 shots. He's -6. I get it. But is that Steve Kerr acknowledging that at some point, you know, he's got to be a part of this?
So the possession you mentioned before we move on,
yeah,
that's the possession Steph turned his ankle briefly. He stayed in the game. It didn't appear to be anything. I'll chalk it up to that. And there were only the game was teetering on the verge of over at that point. But that possession, you know what I thought of? I thought of Oklahoma City, Golden State, 2016. Now, sorry, Thunder fans, this is PTSD for you. But when the Thunder went up 3-1 in that series, you could tell that the Warriors, who are team skill, they've never been team athleticism or team size, they're team skill, that they were overwhelmed and, in basketball terms, scared, not scared, but freaked out by the Thunder's size and leaping ability to the point that they were pump faking defenders who weren't even there. That's what that possession reminded me of. This huge team, wings, arms, everywhere is freaking us out. Who do they go to as the fifth guy is what you're asking, along with the 4 core guys.
Yeah.
I think Boston going small, one effect of that was to kind of get Looney off the floor. Looney only played 2.5 minutes in the fourth quarter. He had 6 of Golden State's 13, I think, offensive rebounds. He was huge. Without him, they had no offensive rebounding.
And by the way, let me just interrupt you for 1 second. Stay on your point, though. Horford had been beaten multiple times by Kevon Looney. Didn't look like himself early, I thought, and then steadied himself and was a monster. Anyway, continue.
6 of 12 offensive rebounds. And I think the difference between the Warriors now and the Warriors of their heyday is it was clear back in the dynastic days that their centers were not among their 5 best players. So you take them off the floor, it's an automatic talent upgrade. If Poole can't survive defensively in this series, it's not clear anymore that Looney is not one of their top 5 players. And so going small becomes a little bit of a sacrifice for them. Andre, look, I love Andre. He's a genius. I thought he held his own defensively against Tatum. Offensively, there's just not a lot there. The Celtics are ignoring him completely. Yeah. They don't care about his rolls to the basket. They don't care if he gets one little slip and drop off. They're just ignoring him. Poole should be the answer. But again, we've talked about that. Gary Payton II didn't play. That surprised me. Wouldn't shock me if Moses Moody got a shot at some point as a 3-and-D kind of type. The Poole party lineup, which is the one we're talking about with Poole as the 5th guy, 3 minutes minus 9. They've steered away from that lineup in the last 2 rounds of the playoffs. Yep. Is Otto Porter the most viable answer? But the Steph, Clay, Wiggins, Porter, Green lineup only played 2 minutes. And Otto Porter made shots. He was fine. I just feel like I don't know if I want to ride with him that much. It wouldn't surprise me if we saw Moody, but I don't know what the answer is. I don't think it's like more, even more Iguodala though.
This is where, you know, and it's funny because I, you know, leading up to the series and having not covered the West, leading up to the series, you know, you're keeping an ear open to where is Gary Payton II in terms of his march back. And before we met with Steve Kerr prior to game one, I was thinking, okay, he'll be a part of this at some point. But then when I spoke with Steve, you know, he kind of gave us the, he'll be questionable. And then, you know, you get the notice that he's going to play, but I didn't, not that it was anything overt Steve Kerr said, but I thought, ooh, I'm less confident that he's prepared to play in this series. And so that's interesting. And just to your point about the Celtics downsizing and sticking with it, there were so many moments where, and I wish I could remember, and I wish I had written down, but you don't necessarily have time. You know, there were so many times where Marcus Smart is guarding up and physically he's just so tough and strong and he's managing bigs and he's managing things all over the floor. And I'm thinking, this guy is something else. And you've written this. There was one article you had written about the Boston Celtics defense that I just thought captured it, where you were like, you know, they're big, they're strong, they communicate, they swallow you up. And Ime actually used that exact wording in like February, said it feels like sometimes we swallow teams up. They are just this juggernaut defensively. You know, when your starters give up 95.5 points per 100 possessions, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around that. And Derek White, I mean, here's a guy, I believe he was 31% in the regular season. You woke me up too damn early for me to have the stats in front of my face.
I offered to push it off, DB. I offered to push it off. It was too late. You were already awake.
If I were with PJ Carlesimo, this wouldn't be a problem. But pizza and pasta at midnight is just going to make me
groggy.
See,
I can't do that. If I start eating multiple dinners, the scale gets ugly fast.
It's just too much fun. And you know you're going to eat well and drink good with red wines. But whatever. But like, I don't know. I forget where I was going with that, but just the willingness of Derek White, who at times was 3-point shot shy, and something he said in the Eastern Conference Finals where he said, and think about this acknowledgement. He said, if I'm going to fail, I'm going to fail aggressively. And he's been everything you want. A guy who can be a secondary ball handler. You can play him in pick and roll. If the ball finds him with open, an open shot, he's not hesitating. They're making all kinds of conversations about how quiet this guy is. What is it about having a baby that all of a sudden these guys start to play their ass off? We've seen this before in the playoffs. Whatever, since his baby was born, Derek White is playing unbelievable basketball. Zach, what's your take? Like Ime Udoka, there's this equanimity about this guy. And this is what I admire about
Equanimity, DB. That means that's like even keeled, right?
Yes, it does. I think one of the things I admire most about these two teams, you know, Boston and Golden State, is they're both going to go back. They're going to look at this film objectively. They're going to look one another in the eye and they're going to say, this is where we failed and we need to fix it. And there's nothing personal taken about it. And this is what's required at this moment. And I just have great respect and admiration for how they conduct their business on both sides.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes! Catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So who's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, watch out for them. You name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. If only starting your fitness journey was as easy as starting this podcast. The truth is, all the lift big, get big, and beach body ready in 3 weeks pressure stops most of us from even starting. And starting is what matters most. It's everything. Wherever you're beginning, wherever you want to be, Peloton encourages you to just start. With thousands of classes to get you moving and doing what you can. If that's a 10-minute low impact class, they've got those. And when you're ready, take it up a gear with a 30-minute live DJ ride. Start with Peloton and find instructors that will keep you motivated to stay on your fitness journey, learn the basics, and build from there. Remember, doing something is everything. Get started with a Peloton bike or bike plus rental at onepeloton.com/bike/rentals. Terms apply. Whatever Ime Udoka has done this season, he has just done a phenomenal job. Whether it's X's and O's, the way he changed their defense halfway through the season, going all in, not all in, but way more in than I expected on small ball in game one of the finals, not wasting any time, and just the general mindset of this team. Now, that can't all be attributed to Ime Udoka. I mean, these guys are veterans now. They've had painful losses in the playoffs. They're ready to win. They've all got their contracts. No one has to worry about their own individual stuff, blah, blah, blah. But this is a tough, resilient team. And I know they've had some ugly fourth quarter moments. I know they're a Jimmy Butler 3 away from having beyond uncomfortable questions asked of them in the offseason. But they didn't. They don't dwell on failures. They don't dwell on in-game runs that go against them. They're calm. They just keep playing. There's a certain toughness about them that I think he has to get some credit for. He's done just an incredible job. And on Derek White, I'm glad you brought that up. At the trade deadline, now the trade deadline is just a whir of insanity, but I was doing a podcast the night of the trade deadline, and we got to the White trade at the end. I think it was me and Bobby Marks. I said, you know, I get it for Boston. I don't love it. You know, it's a lot of draft equity, not a lot, but it's a decent amount of draft equity. You know, they gave up their first this year and a swap right with San Antonio in 2028 that is only protected to top one. Like 2028 is a long time from now. That's kind of a dangerous, lightly protected asset to give up if it indeed kicks in. And I was like, you know, I get it. Derek White brings this sort of selflessness and quick hitting ball movement and cutting and screening, all that stuff they need. But like, he's shooting 30% from three. Boston really needs shooting. They need shooters around Brown and Tatum. I'm not sure that I love it that much. I was like, on the trade. Dead wrong. And you know why I was dead wrong? Not because Derek White has suddenly started shooting it well. Like, he's going to go up and down. That's fine. The Celtics were 32-25 when they made that trade. Their surge was beginning because they were under 500 at like the 40-game mark. Their surge was beginning, but it was not super obvious that they were like a juggernaut in the making at 32-25. They had looked really good, but their schedule, I think they had won like 8 of 9, had been pretty easy. You couldn't, from the outside, just automatically conclude, this is a juggernaut waiting to happen. Internally, the Celtics thought, we've figured something out, and we think we're really, really good. And we view this Derek White trade not like you view it, Zach, in these sort of cold calculating, like, oh, did they give up too much? Let's look at similar trades for similar players, what the value is. We view it as we might be able to win the championship. Wow. And this might be our one piece away. If we have to overpay, quote unquote, a little bit, we don't care because we think we're that good. Similarly, the Kemba Walker plus a first round pick for Al Horford in the offseason, I think to me revealed the Celtics thought, yeah, we were 36-36 last year, totally disappointing. Danny Ainge left, Brad Stevens got a new job, etc. We're throwing that in the garbage. We think we're way better than that. We think that was injuries, COVID just nailed us. Chemistry was bad. We've had this organizational upheaval. We think we're way better. We're willing to pay a first-round pick for a guy who can help our team. And the White trade, whether they win or lose this series, the grade on the Derek White trade is A. I was wrong to be on it. It was A. They had a better sense of their team than I did, and they were right.
Yeah. This is where you have to have that internal feel, and you have to have the guts to make the move and the belief that you are that good. And just to Al Horford, you know, how many moments has this guy had? You know, I go back to the Giannis moment where Giannis flexes on him after that transition play.
Oh, it made him angry. You don't see Al get angry that much.
No, he too is so even-keeled and just like the consummate pro and just going to keep playing and no matter the circumstance and be everything you want in a locker room. And he's sort of shaking his head and not. He's like, okay. You see him say, okay. And he's pissed. And the dunk on Giannis. And just, again, I mean, he was beaten early in this game multiple times by Kevon Looney. And to right yourself in the midst of a 48-minute game one battle in the playoffs and just get right and start making shots and doing all the right things. He's an incredible guy, Al Horford. And I don't know. The Celtics odyssey has been something else this year. Their resilience, their toughness. And I kept saying that, you know, you're talking about the Jimmy Butler three and their record. What were they, 13-22 in quote clutch time games? In even in the playoffs, they're 2-4, I think, in those clutch time games. And I'm looking at every break and talking to Kesty and PJ and going, all right, like, yes, they've gotten this run, but they have been abysmal in these environments. They've got to finish the deal. And they finished the deal in emphatic fashion. So
what was your angle on the Jimmy Butler three? Well, I feel like we still haven't. We move so fast in the NBA. I just can't think of a worse loss. That would have been like a, I don't know how you recover from that loss. It would have been so, but they completely went haywire for three consecutive minutes. That was a good shot. It looked like it was going in. What was your angle? Can you close your eyes and see it? We need to talk more about that.
I can see it. And I thought Miami's winning as he came up the floor and Al Horford is in retreat. Al Horford's backpedaling. He's below the free throw line. And Jimmy Butler was the guy who got you there. I said it emphatically on Scott Van Pelt's show. I'm riding or dying with Jimmy Butler in that moment. I can see it. I'm directly across the court. He's coming up the floor. I'm thinking the Celtics season is over. This is a disastrous collapse when you had command and complete control of the game on the road in game seven. And I really thought, and this, I always hear Jeff Van Gundy talk about all these pockets in these momentary moments in the NBA where franchises are literally, I don't want to say the franchise is hanging in the balance, but your championship is hanging in the balance. And one shot falls versus it doesn't fall, and the changing equation because of that. The fine margin between winning and losing, the fact that you do need a little bit of luck, right? Guys, you've got to stay healthy. You know, does your opponent have somebody out? You know, if the Celtics go on, we are a long way from this, but if the Celtics go on, then people are going to be chirping about no Chris Middleton, blah, 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 blah. And the hurt Miami Heat, blah, 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 blah. This is life in the NBA. This is what it is. Championships take all shapes and forms. Paths take all different forms. Draymond Green said this last night when he was asked about it. And I, Tim Kawakami, the great writer out here, is talking about, is this false bravado from the Golden State Warriors, their reaction saying, you know, Draymond Green saying we dominated for 41 or 42 minutes. We feel pretty good. Those guys aren't going to sustain the shooting, essentially suggesting that in his response. But Draymond Green's response was, we have to do it a different way. We take a different path this year. So we lost in game one. Like, this is The drama of this is what makes this league special. You know, listen, I'm going to Napa today, but
yeah.
Sunday cannot get here fast enough for me.
Give me the wine, like, or what's the type of wine you're gonna want to sample most? Are you a Sauvignon Blanc person? Are you a Merlot person? What are we going for today?
No, listen. So the Jimmy Buffett song, there's a song by Jimmy Buffett, and it says that frozen concoction that helps me hang on.
That's right.
And he's talking about margaritas, I think, or whatever. Listen, I am not LeBron James or Kevin Love. I am going up to Napa to be educated. Cassidy Hubbard has got a spot picked up for us.
Oh, boy.
And I'm just going to go out and enjoy the day and try to pass the hours before the real business at hand, which is game two of the NBA Finals.
I'm so jealous. This sounds just tremendous. You guys are going to get up to some mischief together in Napa. Remember when after the We Believe Warriors upset the Mavs in the first round, the top-seeded Mavs, Dirk Nowitzki, like, went to the Outback and disappeared and, like, grew a beard to reflect on life?
Yes.
If the Celtics lose that game, like, Jaylen Brown or Marcus Smart, if I was on the Celtics, I'm just leaving the arena in my jersey, walking into the Gulf of Mexico and just living on a deserted island. Like, no one will hear from me, and suddenly I'll, like, swim back with a beard down to my toes, be like, okay, I figured out why, with a 5-point lead and 50 seconds left, I drove into Bam Adebayo's face. I'm ready for the next show. Like, that is a walk into the Gulf of Mexico and vanish for 2 months level loss.
The Marcus Smart 3 with 13 ticks on the clock in that setting. And I'm thinking to myself, are you out of your damn
mind? I'm going Tom Hanks in Castaway for a couple months. No one will see me. Brad Stevens is going to be flying helicopters over the Gulf of Mexico trying to find me. For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facility safe and your people safer. Call or click Grainger.com or just stop by. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because of the eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. We should just talk for a second about Boston's defense, which we've been alluding to. After those first 10 minutes, just nailed almost everything. Nailed the switches, nailed the pick and roll coverages. The Warriors scored 90 points per 100 possessions in the half court, which is like a bottom 5-6 mark in the regular season. The half court, they couldn't score enough in Boston. And if you want, you talked about the sequence where you said, oh my God, they're shaking. They're passing up all these threes. If there's a defining sequence for me of this game, it's a three possession sequence that starts at about 5 minutes left in the fourth quarter. The Warriors try to run their beautiful game stuff. They run a Draymond Looney pick and roll, which is unusual. Guess what? Celtics switch that. Tatum goes on to Looney. Horford goes on to Draymond. Off the ball, Steph and Klay screen for each other. Guess what? We switch that. Easy speezy. Derek White and Jaylen Brown switch that. Then Klay Thompson runs off a Kevon Looney pin down. That's kind of dangerous. The side of the floor is open. The Celtics switch that. Jason Tatum goes on to Klay Thompson, and Derek White switches on to Looney. There's a problem, though, Doris, because Derek White was chasing Klay Thompson over the pick. He's stuck on Kevon Looney's back. The Warriors are masters at this. They know in that moment we can get a backdoor cut. And Draymond Green sees it, too. Kevon Looney sees it. He cuts. Draymond has the ball up top. He throws the pass. Al Horford pressuring the passer, not letting Draymond Green see the floor, deflects the pass. It's a turnover. Absolutely perfect defense against like four different things. Al Horford, it's a trailing three. Boom, splash. Next possession, You rarely see this happen with the Warriors. They run nothing. Steph isolates on Peyton Pritchard, just kind of dribbles around a little bit. Nothing there. Kicks to Klay Thompson, dribbles around. Jaylen Brown stones him. Nothing there. Four Warriors are just standing there. You rarely ever see that. Andrew Wiggins gets the ball on a kickout. He tries to isolate against Derek White. Nothing doing. They shrug their shoulders. Okay, Draymond, no one's guarding you. Here's the ball. Take a three. Miss. You never, that's about 4:30 left in the fourth quarter. You rarely ever see the Warriors in after a make with time to think about what they're going to do, do nothing. Do nothing. No actions, no screens, no anything. Just dudes dribbling around. That possession I watched and I said, whoa, the Celtics have knocked them sideways and they don't know what to do anymore. And the Celtics defense, look, switching against the Warriors isn't like switching against everybody else. You got to switch sometimes early to avoid that kind of backdoor cut we're talked about. You got to switch with physicality. You got to know when not to switch. You got to know when to pressure the passer and when to back off. It's really, really hard. Hats off to Boston. The learning curve, the adjustment period to the Warriors knuckleball lasted less than a quarter, and they were masterful from then on.
So back to your point early in this conversation, you talked about the miscommunications, losing Curry in transition. They gave up 6 for 8 threes in the first 12 minutes. There was a moment at which it looked like Steve Kerr went to Steph in the first quarter and basically said, do you want me to lift you here? And I think I'm not 100% sure, but basically I think Steph played the first 12 minutes and he got 6 threes. In the next 26 minutes and 17 seconds, the Boston Celtics gave up 1 three to Stephen Curry, 1 made three to Stephen Curry. What struck me was the number of times where it was inside of 5 seconds on the shot clock and the ball found Draymond Green. He was 0-for-4 from three. He was forced to make shots late in the clock. And there were two possessions, and one of them may have been the one you just described. But I remember, and again, the time to talk in a radio broadcast for the analyst is a tight window. And I just remember twice saying, folks, you can't do it any better defensively. You simply cannot do it any
remember
better.
Remember the push-off that he committed against Smart where he just couldn't get separation from Smart? I mean, how many times have you seen Steph called for a push-off?
He could have been called for two, but Draymond got called for an illegal screen in the middle of the floor, and he was pissed. I couldn't agree more. And again, a lot of it to me is the size. And then the other one, the smallest guy on the floor for the Celtics is Marcus Smart. But the smallest guy is the heart of a lion and the smarts to match the heart. And listen, we're really excited, obviously, about what you saw from the Boston Celtics, because I think to have a great series, they were going to have to perform well here on the road. And they did that. And now it's up to a champion to respond. And I certainly expect them to do that.
Yeah, it's hard to go down. It's very obvious, but, you know, you don't have home court. There is a tendency to think, well, just take it a game at a time. If we go down 2-0, we haven't lost a home game yet. It's just hard to beat the Warriors 4 and 5. I don't care where the games are. It's hard to beat them 4 and 5. They're too good on both ends of the floor. They had to get one of these first two, and now they go for the jugular, so to speak, in game two.
8-2 on the road. 8-2 the Boston Celtics on the road in the playoffs.
And it's got to be refreshing as a Celtics fan to see them like take a lead in a series instead of having to win, you know, the next game, because they never lose two in a row. But it would be nice to try to win two in a row. First of all, Draymond, you mentioned 2 of 12, 0 of 3 at the line, missed 2 free throws when they were kind of clinging to life in the fourth quarter. 4 points, 5 assists, 3 turnovers, fouled out. Just has to be better. Clay's got to be a little better. He was kind of quiet. Beyond just play better. I do think, you know, there's a tendency to overreact and say, wow, Boston, impressive, blah, blah, blah. Like, Golden State's still here. They're fine. They're going to try their best to rebound, obviously. What might we see, other than the lineup machinations that we talked about, what might we see from them, or what should we see from them in game two that might help turn the tables a little bit?
Well, I just don't think that they're going to have these moments where they don't run anything, where they allow Boston to take them out of what they're trying to do. You know, they are the hardest team to guard in the half court because of the multi-actions. I just expect them to be better all around. You know, I'm curious to see about Gary Payton II. I mean, Zach, do you know anything that I don't about whether or not he is is going to be able to play, or are they just sort of holding that out there to be making the Celtics think? I don't know.
I don't know either. This is not the time where I'm going to get the best information. Everyone's going to try to play poker at this point.
I just think they're going to be better. I think Draymond Green will be better. I don't think he goes 2 for 12. I just don't. I expect a better performance finishing in opportunities, not necessarily making threes. Although one thing I will say is I felt like Draymond Green was more, there were times in this playoff run, and you correct me if I'm wrong, where, remember the best year he had, he was making some of those threes and he certainly was willing to take them. I felt like I've seen glimpses of that Draymond in this run up. Am I out of my mind on that?
He's made some big threes. I just think that Draymond is gone forever. The one who hit all those threes in Game 7 against the Cavs in 2016 when they lost and all that. I just think that guy's that was a one-year jump shot fluke, and we're never going to see that guy again. And most of his threes are going to look like they did in Game 1. And by the way, that's fine. He does a lot of other great things, and he knows better than anyone how to leverage you ignoring him into getting shots for his teammates. Some things that I'm going to look for the Warriors that I want your thoughts on. I was surprised how often they gave the switch of Curry onto Tatum and Poole onto Tatum when we just saw them against Luka do so well with Steph hedging out and recovering. And I don't think it killed them. Like, Tatum was just 3 of 17. Steph is pretty physical now in his late prime, so to speak. He'll body up people as best he can and forced a couple of tough floaters. The help from the Warriors was aggressive and there, but the help has much less distance to travel when Robert Williams is in the dunker spot and Al Horford is in the corner behind him than it does when there's only one of those guys on the floor and all of a sudden the floor is better space. I wonder if we'll see them try to get under more Smart Tatum pick and rolls when Smart is the ball handler. Now, Tatum's become very good at kind of bulldozing his way down and forcing that switch, but maybe more hedging, more going under. And I was surprised when the Warriors went small. I thought one of the benefits of that to them would be they had a little more freedom against Boston's small lineups. If they were both small, that they would have a little more freedom to play around with who Draymond Green guarded. Like, we could put Otto Porter on Al Horford and have Draymond on Jaylen Brown or Marcus Smart or something like that. I thought we might see that, and I think we might see it in Game 2.
I think you'll see more Draymond on Jaylen, that's for sure. To your point about Steph on Tatum, there were two plays in particular, back-to-back possessions, where he catches it sort of, you know, Steph battles him. He catches it mid-post area. I feel like he forced one tough shot and forced him to become a passer. So to your point, I absolutely think you're going to see more Draymond on Jaylen. And you made a great point. Like, Steph was really good hedging out and then, you know, being clean there to get the matchup they wanted defensively. Yeah, and I agree with you about Looney. If Poole can't play, he is your fifth best guy. And just how funny is, first of all, a shout to Kevon, because Steve Kerr said early in the year, and he's 100% right, I had a Golden State game, and I described Kevon Looney as really solid defensively. And Steve Kerr in a interview said, blank that the guy is, you know, and he went on and on about how smart Kevon Looney is. And to Kevon's credit, he's rebounded at a higher rate. He's finished at a higher rate than he's ever had. And he probably doesn't get enough credit for what he does defensively. And the other thing is, I am anxious to see Jordan Poole's response. I am. He earned the trust of those two guys, Steph and Dre, in that 15-5 and in the play-in game against Memphis. And I was stunned at how young he looked. I do expect him to play better in his minutes.
Well, in going through all of those who's the fifth guy options, you know, Porter, Iguodala, aside from Looney, who we know is going to start at center when they go small, you know, will we see Payton? Will we see Moody? I just... This is a very dumb aside. I miss Juan Toscano-Anderson. I was kind of surprised he just completely fell out of their rotation in the regular season, because I think he's actually good. Probably too late to play that card. Damian Lee is, I guess, now a deep bench guy. In going through all those options, what I came to in the end was, defense aside, not defense aside, but we know what the defensive issues are. They're just going to need Poole to win the series. And I don't know if that means they've got to get braver. Not braver is the wrong word, because it's not like they're not brave. But if they've got to just sort of play that Poole party lineup a little bit more and see how bad it gets defensively versus how good it can be offensively, or just mix and match so he's out there more with their best players. And going through those options, I'm like, they're just point blank. They're just going to need him. They're just going to need him to win the series, because Boston is that good. And if Jordan Poole's just not good enough to play in this series, he's going to play in this series. I mean, we're being sort of, a flip saying that. But if he's not good enough to be trusted to play 25 or 30 minutes or whatever, and he's going to get exploited defensively and going to be a net negative, then, I think then he's just maybe not as good as he looked in the regular season when the competition gets elite, elite, elite. Because you go through all those answers and I'm like, those are all fine kind of stopgap answers, but they're going to need Jordan Poole.
I refuse to believe that he's just not good enough. It feels like you have to trust what you saw with your eyes through the run. And I am on the side that he's going to be good enough. I just don't expect him to go 2 for 7, 4 turnovers, and look as young as he looked. I don't see that. I don't see that.
He cannot be a piece of tissue paper floating around on defense. He has to show some.
I remember saying this on a telecast earlier. The question is, and I think you and I have had this conversation, and these are the things you see early that you say, can he hold up? Can he hold up? Can Jordan Poole, can those lineups in those minutes when you are that small, can they hold up? This is the question. This is the question. And we asked it when we first saw it.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, I think it sometimes gets portrayed as like this parlor trick. Oh, pool party, little short minute burst, Curry and Poole. No, Curry and Poole together with Draymond was like a massive part of their turnaround. It was not just a random parlor trick. Let's wrap real quickly. What did you think of Ime opening with Robert Williams on Andrew Wiggins, which I speculated about on my podcast and in my column, and then sort of concluded that it kind of feels too cute. And they came off of it in the third quarter. They put him onto Looney. I wonder where he'll start game two, if it's Wiggins or if it's Looney. What did you see there that you liked and you didn't? I mean, I get the idea of it. I talked through it before the series. I think there's some smart reasoning behind it. Obviously, the Warriors are going to try and attack it with Curry, Wiggins, pick and rolls, and sort of test them out that way. And I think the idea of it is, you do that. You run Curry, Wiggins, pick and rolls. In the starting five, that means Looney and Draymond are somewhere behind the play, so your spacing is not going to be great. Not going to be as good as it would be if one of those guys were screening for Steph. But what did you think of it and how the Warriors responded to it?
It's funny because one thing I've said throughout the course of this run for the Celtics is, and I thought you saw this on display in the Miami series, particularly in game 7, where, Robert Williams bumped his knee early and just didn't move the same the rest of the way. You've talked about how the defense elevated as soon as they made the switch to putting Robert on the wings and letting him roam around. And even Steve Kerr prior to game 1 said, because I asked Steve Kerr this point blank, basically, what do you expect? What does it look like if he's healthy versus not? And he said, listen, just what you said, we're going to put him in the screening action if he's guarding a wing, and we're going to play out of that, and we're confident about what we'll get. And I had read your preview after interviewing Steve, and I saw the line about having him guard Wiggins could be too cute. And I just smiled because I asked Ime, who is he going to check to start? And he said, Wiggins. I just put a big smile on my face. It goes back to your point, I think, Celtics downsized. Who's the big? If Al Horford's shooting it the way he is, how many minutes does Robert Williams get moving forward? I do think they may go back to the Kevon Looney matchup as opposed to that with Robert Williams. And again, you know, the beauty is, you know, you can probably do both as long as Robert's getting 2 days between. And so he can be at that point of attack if there is the pick and roll with Wiggins and Curry. Is he Robert who can move laterally? He surprises people, I think. He surprises people with his ability to be in the middle of the paint, shading off of Wiggins, and still get out and contest a shot. I mean, I don't know how many threes he's blocked this year, Zach, but it's quite a few. So I think that's the beauty of the Celtics is you can move all these parts and pieces around and adjust on the fly. I don't know. I don't know. I would start him on Looney.
Me too.
I would start him on Looney, but I don't know what Ime is going to do.
Well, the interesting thing is, regardless of who Robert Williams defends, in the second half they started doing the thing where the Warriors would call his guy up for a pick and roll, and the Celtics would switch him out of it in the middle of the play, so before the pick actually happened.
Yeah. Yep.
And then the Warriors would say, okay, so you switched him over there. We'll just bring that other guy up so you're still involved. The dangerous thing about that against the Warriors is when you play that kind of mix and match, then you get caught up in, okay, are we trying to get back to our original assignments now, or are we sticking with these? And the Warriors move so fast that if you're confused for half a second, all of a sudden one of the Splash Brothers is going to be launching an open three. So I would keep an eye on that. And I say this, I say the following, I'm cursing myself saying this. Daniel Tice is probably going to score like 14 points on 7 of 7 shooting in game 2. I just don't understand why he continues to play. I know he made a shot last night. Did he make a three? Was it a long two or it was a three?
He made a three. Yeah. I'm with you. I just
don't get it. The Celtics love Daniel Tice. They just can't get enough of Daniel. Daniel Tice, if Daniel Tice gets traded in the next 18 months, they will trade back. They will trade for him back like 6 months later. I just don't get why he's playing, especially if you're going to go small a lot. But hey, look, hats off to him. He made a shot. DB, I will see you soon. If there's a pizza, pasta, wine, yeah. Just keep me in. I'm not, you know, the Napa wine tasting with Cassie, that could get out of hand. I don't know if I want any part of that. But the pizza, pasta, post-game wine, I want PJ Carlissimo to be, like, really, really gruff and telling old stories about Seton Hall and whatever, Terry DeHaire and stuff like that. Can we make that happen?
Oh, shoot. Terry DeHaire, that guy could shoot it. He was electric. Are you kidding me? John Morton. Oh, yeah. PJ's got all the stories. And we would love for you to join us in our post-game pizza pasta. I promised myself. I literally said to Marques Desharm, I said, I'm going to be so disciplined. I'm going to have a protein and a salad. Next thing you know, before we even sit down, like four pizzas to send on the table, I take one sip of wine and everything went out the window.
No, you can't. You put pizza in front of me. It's a debate in my house. Because once you have kids, see, I didn't realize this. Your pizza frequency with kids, it goes up like 500%. Because when they're all together, when you have an outdoor gathering, the easiest response is like, let's just order a bunch of pizzas. Every kid's birthday party is pizza. So I've realized I could eat pizza literally every single day for multiple meals. My wife is like, get sick of pizza after like a little too much over a couple weeks. If you put pizza, it doesn't even – when kids' birthday parties are like at 3 o'clock, so I've already had lunch and dinner is coming – and there's pizza at the birthday party, I'm like, it's just entrapment. You're just creating an extra meal for me because I don't even know what could be happening around me. An earthquake could be happening. If there's pizza, I don't even care what the topping is. I'm eating the pizza. So you're just setting me up to get fat with a 3 p.m. pizza option. I can't resist it. It's impossible. This is a lot of information. I'm sorry.
Piazza, I think, is the name of the place we went to. The pizza was absolutely stellar, and the company is just exceptional. So, hey, listen, all I know is I'm lucky. I can't wait to get to game 2 and see what Steve and he may have in mind and see what these incredible players do. It's last night was so fun, Zach, and I felt like Boston had to get one here in order to make this the series we thought it was, and they did. And you're right. Now, prosperity has not been kind to the Boston Celtics. They tend to make things hard on themselves. So we'll see how they react from here.
Well, I think we both picked Warriors in 7.
We did, yeah.
In theory, the Celtics winning game one should not really dissuade us from such a long extended pick like that. I did come away from that game one feeling like, ooh, that was a pretty emphatic Boston win. And you can show me the 21 threes and all that, and obviously those guys won't shoot like that, blah, blah, blah. It felt like a piece of information that changed the way I thought about the series a little bit.
Sure, I would agree with that. And I would agree with that because of the way they were able to defend after the first quarter. The mind-boggling mistakes. There's a transition three by Steph where Derek White and one other Celtic were standing right there. And they both ran in the other direction. I said, what the hell are you?
It was Pritchard. It was Pritchard the other way.
I'm like, are you kidding me? Two guys just walked away, or actually turned and jogged away from the greatest shooter in history.
You know what would actually be fun? It would actually be fun if you could make this like an attraction that you would pay like an enormous amount of money for. In a 5-on-5 situation, I would want to see how it feels like, because you see some teams do this where, okay, so I'm playing the real Warriors and you just plop me onto the defensive team and you say, your only job is literally ignore everything else happening on the floor. Do not avert your vision from Steph Curry. It could be Wilt Chamberlain, Bill Russell, Michael Jordan, and LeBron James. You don't care. Your only job is to chase him around. Do not pay it. I don't care if he's 75 feet from the hoop or at the basket. That's your only job. I would fail on that after one cut by Steph Curry. I'd be in the dust. I just would like to see what it feels like to just – because when you play pickup, you don't just have one job. Like, some guys are just face guard him 94 feet. I just would like to see what that feels like. I would pay some money to do that, and it would be horrible. But it's very unique. But to your point, it's like, dude, that's Steph Curry. Just guard him no matter where he is.
Right. And if somebody's coming up the floor who should not be left – unattended in transition, it's that guy. Go find everybody, you know, leave everybody else the hell alone. Oh, it was too funny.
All right, doors work. That's enough. I've wasted enough of your time. You're the best to indulge me on this stupid podcast. The one and only Doris Burke, I will see you soon. Thank you for your time. Keep up the great work on ESPN Radio and in all formats that we see you. You're the best, TV.
Thanks for having me, Seth.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.